higher performance, and faster and more reliable.
Welcome to Open Paddock number 216 for Tuesday, January 28th, 2014. Tonight on the show, hardly any news out of IndyCar, but we will talk about it anyway. On the sports car front, we have results and commentary on the Daytona 24 hours of vastly superior machinery being performance matched to antiquated tube frame crap. Rally America, we've got snowdrift results, Higgins wins in the SRT USA entry, and in other news, the sky is blue. And a little thing called NBC Sports will be televising rallies. F1 car launches and testing will be giving us Photoshop fodder for years to come. Zenazi spanking punishments shall be forgotten. So kick back, relax, have some tea, and look at those racy F1 nose picks. Max Mosley welcomes you to this very special edition of Open Paddock. Gentlemen, welcome. Well, once more, we gather and enjoy our discussion on motorsports. But tonight, for the roll call, we'll start with Mr. Peachin. Sean, what are you drinking?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am actually drinking something. I've just run out, so I'm going to go get a refill after I do this. But I am having some Captain Morgan Special Reserve on the rocks.
Straight up.
Straight, right. Bro.
It's going to be one of those nights. Dr. Patterson.
I am enjoying a gift that was given to me by a very, very good friend. I am enjoying a glass of Jameson's Special Reserve 18-year-old fine Irish whiskey. Hmm. Neat, of course. Very
nice. Of course.
Mike, how are you faring this evening?
Faring very well. I've got myself a nice little gin and tonic, again with that local Aviator gin. Good stuff.
Very good. Tonight I'm breaking the trend and I'm going with an IPA. Mm. It's from Deschutes Brewery, which just moved into Ohio, and it's from Bend, Oregon. So Mike
Oregon
shall celebrate.
To Ohio.
Yeah. The Oregon to Ohio Beer Exchange Program is in full effect. and since I'm drinking the low test stuff, I already had two before the show. This could be interesting.
Oh my!
this is what we call the equivalency formula.
Indeed. Boy, that would be a great segue into the sports car format. But tonight, to kick off the show for our miscellaneous news. NASCAR has been dominating miscellaneous lately. Last show, we talked about NASCAR's possible new points format and chase format. But now we talk about NASCAR and their new quali format. You guys had a chance to look in to see what NASCAR is doing, what Nasty is brewing.
NAS what?
Yeah.
What car?
Yeah.
The what?
Okay, since you're feigning ignorance.
NASCAR, I don't have to paint it.
They're going to a knockout qualifying format for ovals. They will be doing qualifying sessions with multiple cars on track and best lap times move forward in their knockout qualifying, which I think is an interesting change to oval qualifying. I will admit that I could care less about oval qualifying. Oval qualifying outside of the Indy 500 has no meaning or bearing on my life whatsoever. Is that a fair statement for your feelings on oval qualifying?
Yes.
To the team? Okay.
Yes. I don't watch it. I mean, what's the point? I mean, usually it's like one guy going in a circle. Now you're going to have multiple guys going in a circle. So essentially a glorified practice session that will in turn determine the starting order for your performance auto race that will inevitably be screwed over by 7 phantom cautions and come down to a green white checkered.
Well, and that's just the problem with oval qualifying. The oval qualifying never really matters. It doesn't matter what track you're at. Yes, it does help that you're not in the middle of the pack and amongst the scrum, if you will. At the start of the race in the dirty air, but you can get around that. You can improve your position, and if you have a good car, you can be up at the front fairly quickly.
If
that's the same for IndyCar and NASCAR. for that.
Well, I remember if Scott Sharp proved that you could start at the front of the field and that doesn't even save you.
I was in the elevator when that crash happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It was the year I had a silver badge, and I was on the track when they gave the command, and I was in the elevator up to the media tower when he crashed.
All I'm saying is I love, you know, obviously I love Scott Sharp, great sports car driver, but he happened to be my favorite driver when that happened, and that was a tough day to be a Scott Sharp fan, just saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not really going to go too deep into it, but I will say I'm not surprised to see them make this change in qualifying, because nobody cares about NASCAR single-lap qualifying sessions that could last for hours on end. However, you're getting away from pure competition while you're doing it, but that hasn't bothered NASCAR for years. But on the other side, it does give tracks something more to promote than come out for a three-hour session watching these cars circulate one at a time.
Oh, yeah, you got to do what you got to do. I mean, if it adds parity or whatnot to the race weekend versus one car, I mean, more power to them. But I can assure you that it's not going to make me want to watch it any more than I already was. So I'm not too, you know, high up on it, I guess, you know?
Fair enough and understandable. I guess the question I put before the panel tonight, though, is if NASCAR is doing this with oval track qualifying, is IndyCar far behind?
I don't think personally that we'll see IndyCar do it, and the reason why I say that is because they're perfectly content with doing their own gimmicks. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we've got a pretty good idea. I mean, what was it there, Mike, with the complex process that they did?
Oh, yes.
The USAC qualifying format.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, I just don't get it. There's more gimmicks than one of those circuses or whatever, fairs, little fair people who take all your money at the games. So I just don't get it. Trickery. That's what it is, trickery.
You're right, Mike. You know, IndyCar, yeah, both of you, you're right in that IndyCar hasn't shied away from doing odd formats. You know, they've done the duel at Texas with the flipping tires. They've done the stuff at Iowa for the last couple of years and the different formats that they've done there. I don't know if we'll see them expand that. I haven't heard anything to that point this year. Guess we're just going to have to wait and see what IndyCar chooses to do. But I'm of the opinion that if NASCAR's trialing it, it's not far behind that IndyCar is going to be doing it too. And I don't see too much problem in that, because oval qualifying doesn't matter. You're not giving the tracks anything to sell. The only place that it does matter is Indy, and that's because $100,000 is on the line for getting pole.
Yeah. Well, my thing is this, though. It's like, if the poor teams – I mean, sure, okay, so the poor teams can go out and do, like, a lap on the oval or four laps or whatever. Is it really going to be worth it to go out there for, like, 20 minutes for Group A? I mean, what if you wreck your car? I mean, what if you break something? I mean, it's already bad enough that cars have to be on the track with each – I mean, now Formula One, a little bit different, but it's already bad enough that Indy cars have to be on the same track with each other at the same time. I mean, because God knows, like, they can't do that.
Well, so, and I think you're on to something here, especially when it comes to oval racing. You know, yes, when you're on track doing a group qualifying session on a road circuit, okay, sometimes you have to deal with traffic, right? But on an oval, I mean, you are so much more on the edge of stability during your qualifying run. You know, well, think about, you know, what people say when they're qualifying for the 500, right? That it's the scariest four laps of your life, because you're right on that razor's edge of wiping out and hitting the wall every second. And having a group qualifying session on an oval. That sounds bad.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll make them race in the format that they qualify in, as far as downforce levels and all of that kind of stuff.
That would be risky.
Well, the reason I ask is because that might make everybody do more race setups instead of qualifying trim. Because here's the spectacle that you'll get with group qualifying is teams going out there and setting, you know, quick lap times and toes.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. Exactly. So didn't we sort of try this at Iowa? The whole heat qualifying type of thing?
Yeah, because they went into their heats based on their practice times, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. So to some extent, yeah, they've done a little bit of it. Oh, well. It will be fun to see how this shakes out. Or I should say, it will be fun to hear how this shakes out, because I'm not going to watch any qualifying just to find out. But that segues nicely into IndyCar. The very brief amount of news we have in IndyCar this evening. Panther is testing this Huertas kid again. And it is interesting that, you know, they're doing this test with this Huertas guy. But somebody wrote in a question to Mr. Cavan at the Star and asks what's the status of the National Guard sponsorship. And currently, according to Cavan, again, that has not been assigned, and a fun little thing, according to him, there has been a protest filed by Panther Brands to the U.S. Government Accountability Office website.
Oh, no.
So, not saying they've lost the sponsorship, but I don't know what you'd be protesting about.
Well, can I tell you something? Mm-hmm. As a person who's firsthand dealt with, well, I deal with the government on it every day. you're not going to get any resolution to that problem this year or next year. So your complaint, Mr. Barnes, will be heard in approximately 3 years' time.
Nice.
So I hope that doesn't put a damper on your time-sensitive plans, but the government doesn't give a damn enough to give you that kind of, you know, hurry up and wait. So good luck with that.
Well, we've heard that Ray Hall Letterman is in the running for that sponsorship. Actually, we've heard from some sources that it's a done deal, though it has not formally been announced by any party. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, well, it was just a blog source, just to cover this, because it was a bit of a point of contention yesterday on the Twitter sphere. There was a disturbance in the force. Of course, I went to Twitter because that's the first place I go, and then usually track for him. But yeah, apparently a gentleman with his own blog had posted that he had a friend that was at like Ray Hall Lanigan or something of that nature, and that Servia was supposed to be the second driver that was going to be signed, whatever that Graham Ray Hall was talking about at Daytona, and that the National Guard sponsorship was going to go to Graham Ray Hall, and that the Blue E-Sig sponsor and all that stuff was going to go on to Servius' car. Now,
yay!
Now, I must stress that this is not official. This is not confirmed. This is just some guy. You know, in the business, we call this third-hand access. This is a guy talking to a guy talking to a guy. It's not a vetted source like, you know, you're used to seeing in the media. You don't really know. But there was a lot of whiplash on the Twitter sphere for this gentleman posting this story or posting this on his own blog, apparently, and all the IndyCar blogs jumped on this, like, this whole entire, this isn't good for IndyCar, and you shouldn't be doing that, and blah, 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 acting like they were actually, you know, because they actually are professionals, apparently. I mean, we forget that we're all bloggers, and, you know, but apparently some of us are more professional than others.
We're word butchers.
Yeah,
you know.
So, but it was just really annoying because this guy was essentially crucified by the whole entire community for no reason, because they are no more qualified to speak on the behalf of IndyCar or what is good for IndyCar or what is bad for IndyCar than anybody else. I simply said, in my position on anything that ever happens like this, is there's a freedom of speech, If somebody tells you something and you haven't signed an NDA or some kind of non-disclosure statement, then you can say whatever you want. And it's up to the people who read it to, you know, to give you credence or credibility. But I in no way, shape, or form think that hurts IndyCar or IndyCar blogging. What I think it does hurt is perhaps this person who was talking to this gentleman should be investigated by the race team for giving out critical and sensitive information that he was not supposed to be, you know. It's like, what do they say in Washington, D.C.? An unnamed source who couldn't speak on the situation because it was a top secret investigation has come forward and said. So I just wanted to get that out there. I support the fact that he wrote it because he has the right to do so. I don't think that any blogger of any type or any writer for any site that is not official accredited ESPN or IndyCar or Racer Autosport should really have the ability to say anything about anything and really judge. Sure, give your opinion, but don't crucify this guy because he's wrote something that he believes is like a scoop, if you will, or whatever they call it, breaking news. I remember Neely actually got his butt slammed in the door
last year. I was
going to
bring that up, all of a sudden, oh, he's right.
yeah, exactly. That's the thing. That is the thing. You get all these writers who get so mad and so butthurt about, well, you can't be writing that, and that's not official. If the dude got it, dude got it. And
that's
I remember
right.
We took a lot of heat. When we announced on our site, albeit ahead of the time limit or ahead of the time schedule, that EJ Viso was a done deal at Andretti and that he was bringing some sponsorship to Andretti to run another car. And I was a little suspect, and I almost didn't think it was going to happen. I was starting to lose faith, but then it was finally announced as a done deal. And I was like, ha-ha, vindicated. But we had guys all over the internet telling us how low down, dirty, and crummy we were. But I'm here to tell you, from what I was looking at earlier, our hits have never been higher, and our show's never gotten more downloads. So obviously it doesn't hurt you that bad. And all the teams still work with us on a regular basis, whether it be IndyCar or Mazda Road to Indy. None of them, you know, I don't think it was a real big credibility hit. So, and, you know, again, we're bloggers. We do it for fun. If somebody tells us something and we're not bound by a non-disclosure agreement or anything of the nature and you want to post it, by all means. So, but there, I've spoke my piece about it. We can move on.
I hate to be this way, but, you know, all those other blogs and people who were butt hurt about it, as you put it, if they had the same information, they would have ran with it too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Most definitely. If you look at any of those guys who would have got a tip like that or a piece of intel like that, they would have taken it to the bank. And that you can count on. I don't care. You know, I don't care. So, go ahead. On with the
show. The other IndyCar news this evening is that Justin Wilson has signed with Coyne again.
Oh, boy.
No surprise.
Yes and no. His engineer took off. And
A lot of people felt that
was the reason that he was sticking around was because Bill Pappas was engineering for him.
Well, my question is this, like, how – I mean, how can this guy not get a ride in another place?
Exactly.
How is he not getting called by people like – I mean, how is he not on the top of the free agent list for, like, people like Panther or people, you know, who are looking for drivers or people like that? Because, I mean, this guy's a stud.
Ganassi.
Yeah, Ganassi, B-team. I mean, the guy's a stud. He's proven that he can get it done on the oval. He can get it done on the oval. He won on the oval. Granted, the car was then deemed illegal, but he won the race. And I mean, he's good on the road courses. That goes without saying. So I'm just a little surprised that somebody like Justin Wilson, and the pedigree of a driver that Justin is having such a difficult time getting out of this Coyne ride, because I think the Coyne ride is really hampering his ability to be, that taken to the next level. No offense to Mr. Coyne, because I love, you know, I like Dale Coyne Racing. I have nothing against him. I'm just saying I think a driver of Wilson's caliber certainly should be at least considered for a Ganassi B-team slot, at least.
Yeah, and then, you know, to give some balance to this one, I have heard from a few sources that that Justin very much likes driving for coin because there's not a lot of the bull crap that you have to deal with at some of the other teams. So there may be less politics. There may be some of that there. I can't imagine though you'd turn down a better ride just because you didn't want to deal with politics.
Well, I mean, in IndyCar, more than probably any other series on the face of the earth, you know, you're not driving an IndyCar unless you're good at some level of politicking and boardroom discussioning. So, you know, I can't really think – I don't really understand why maybe he just wants to do less of that, but he has to be qualified at a minimum.
He's grown quite the taste for Finlandia vodka and Häagen-Dazs.
Oh God, don't talk to me. Well, no, I don't mind Finlandia. It's Svedka. Don't ever mention Svedka. Every time I drink it, I get a horrendous headache. I don't know what it is about their distilling process, but Svedka is 1,000 times worse than Finlandia. Sorry, minor offshoot there.
Yeah, well. So we have a report today that there's a 70% chance of Bush at the 500.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Kurt Busch was talking. And,
Kurt Busch.
Right.
Kurt I thought Busch, we were going yes. to talk about the snake pit.
Oh.
Good God. Good God.
Are you talking about the underarms of all the ladies there?
Sure. Let's go with that.
Out of control. PG, boys. PG.
Armpits. Seriously.
Get out of here.
Anyway, Kurt Busch puts his chances at 70% of running the Indy 500 this year because of recent developments that have pushed a potential racing program along. Okay. Basically, you know, that's the beginning of an article in the Indianapolis Star. It sounds like Stuart Haas Racing, Gene Haas and Tony Stewart have basically said he is allowed. If the driver wanted to, he could. So he's out there trying to figure out if he can figure out a way of doing it, you know, along with, you know, NASCAR's Coca-Cola 600 the same day, he's going to. Don't know exactly with who. It sounds like he's working on logistics. 70% chance probably equals about 20% chance, though. I mean,
I think only 20% chance that he does it.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm not putting his probability as very high. Yeah, let's say he's got all the approval from his team. He still has to find another team. An IndyCar team to help him along, and the funding has to be there to do that, and I don't know for sure if they're going to be able to get it together. Let's see.
Yeah,
I'm just being Debbie Downer.
I think Debbie Downer is, I mean, it's not too unrealistic, but I think that somebody will jump out there for a guy like Busch just to see it. I don't know if it'll be one of his normal sponsors, but, you know, I'm going to be the optimist. I know. Brace yourselves, but I will be the optimist today. And I will say that I think that Kurt Busch does race in the Indy 500 and that a sponsor does come forward and, puts up the money for him.
Well, as with all things, shall I wait and see? And it would be a good thing for the 500 if Kurt Busch ran at the 500 this year. It would be a bad thing if Kurt Busch runs the 500 and halfway through gets out of the car and is spelled by somebody else because he has no chance of winning.
That would suck.
Well, because he's got this NASCAR thing, you know? Mm-hmm. If he isn't doing well at the 500, there's a good chance he gets out and somebody else gets in the car so he can get on a plane and get to his real job.
It could be.
So, moving on, let's jump into some Mazda Road to Indy news. Doug, I'm going to let you run with this.
So we had some driver announcements, all of them this week from USF 2000. Not surprising. I mean, that's really your entry level. That's where you're going to see the majority of the cards anyway. I think Pro Mazda and certainly Indy Lights are going to be certainly more populated this year than they were last. But still, USF 2000 is where you're going to see the majority of the cars. Austin Cindric is back in the series. He's going to be racing for Pabst Racing. And J Motorsport has three cars returning, including Heinrich Ferusuth again, and Colton Herta and Adrian Sorrentino. Herta and Sorrentino are from 16. I think Sorrentino was 1600 Formula Ford, and Herta, was he the same? I'd have to look it up. But anyway, of course, we know Heinrich fairly well. Last year was his first season in the championship cars. He had won the title in the national class cars, the old Formula Enterprise chassis. Of course, now they're moving to a single chassis. They've gotten rid of the split specification, and they're all using the champion class Van Diemen's. So it'll be interesting to see for us. In what really we should call his second year in USF 2000. It's his second year in the top class. And Austin, I'd like to see him do a little better than he did last year. I was kind of lukewarm on his performance last year. I think he's got potential. But let's hope that that he steps it up a bit this year. With Pabst Racing, that's not a bad group to be with. And we've already got, let's see, what is this? 16 cars already for the USF 2000 series. So coming right along, and just around the corner, we have the we had the Winterfest, so looking forward to seeing cars on track once again.
Love to see that kind of lineup for Indy Lights.
Indy Lights is, I think you're going to see low teens every race, which I know that sounds great, but it's better than last year. Motegi Wheels came on as a series sponsor or partner. For 2014, so that's good. I think there's a lot of things that are starting to take shape and fall into place that's really going to make this a very good year for Indy Lights, and it'll provide a good run up to the debut of the new equipment in 2015. I think 2015 you're going to see participation in lights really explode.
Interesting. Well, and why would, and I guess I'll just ask the question, why do you say that?
I say that because there's been a lot of buzz. You listen to a lot of the people that have been in the series in the past, whether it's the folk from O2, people like Team E and FanForce. Some of these other teams that have been kind of one-offs or maybe partial series deals, there's a lot of buzz of looking not this year but at next year when the new equipment comes out, being very excited about putting together a package, maybe doing a few races this year, but really making full-time efforts in 2015. So
I say
that from the buzz behind from what I've been seeing.
Yeah, I thought I was even hearing like international guys from Europe looking at coming to do lights.
Oh yeah, in fact they're for the 2015 chassis they're looking at doing a test over in Europe someplace, and we talked about that before.
Right.
So yeah, I think very easily you could. You could see some of the teams that maybe the more successful teams that want to branch out, or even some of the teams maybe they're struggling to put something together for GP3, GP2, but they have enough to come over and put together a package for Indy Lights and make a run of it over here. not to. I know it sounds like I'm short selling Indy Lights, and I don't mean that. But I mean you've got a lot of talent, especially in GP2, in GP3, where you have to look at, well, where am I getting my return on investment? Where am I getting the most bang for my buck? I could spend an absolute insane amount of money in GP2 and be an also-ran, or maybe I could come over to Indy Lights and be a contender. Hmm. You know, so I think some of that might play out. But, no, the European thing aside, I think there's a lot of domestic players who are very excited about 2014.
All right.
Or 2015. We're excited about 2014, too. But I'm old, and I apparently live in the past and can't wrap my head around the fact that this is 2014 now.
Nice. Well, we will see as Anderson Promotions pushes forward with control of the entire ladder, how that affects. I mean, obviously, we've got a little more interest. You know, a lot of these sponsorships, like you said, Motegi's coming on board. And good things for the future of Indy Lights, because it can only go up from 8 cars.
No. As well, Formula Atlantic proved, it could go down as well.
fair enough. Okay, moving on. That jumps us right into the special edition sports car section of the program this evening, because this weekend was the 24 Hours of Daytona, the Rolex 24, the first of its kind, in that this was the first of the United Sports Car Racing Championship presented by Tudor, or whatever they're going to call themselves next week. Gentlemen, I'm going to let you run with it, because you know my proclivities on this stuff.
Yes. Well, we had finally, after the whole entire off season, all the concern, what was going to happen with the Grand Am series now merging with the American Le Mans series. Out came the Tudor, as it was called. I learned finally how to say it because of all the commercials during the broadcast. The Tudor United Sports Car Championship. So that's what we had to deal with, and that was what was on tap for the annual, 52nd annual, actually, Daytona Rolex 24-hour race. First time that we were able to actually see the cars in anger, besides the test, obviously. The roar before the 24 don't really count. But how the rules, how the balancing of the classes, how the mixing of the cars, especially the mixing of the Daytona prototypes, which we at the site were always a bit less fond of, would stack up against the P2 cars from the American Le Mans series. And then we also had the GT Le Mans cars come on, you know, to participate in the usual, what we would call the old school GT1. And then we had the GT Daytona, which was the Pro-Am class for the GT. So we had obviously the PC as well. So the Pro-Am PC class was there. And then the Pro-Am GT Daytona was there to complement the prototypes and the GT Le Mans. The race was a 24-hour race. I mean, nothing really super spectacular. You know, the race started, the race kind of went on and went on about its way. We did obviously have that super scary accident.
That was mega.
Yeah, with the Gainsco 99 going into the back of the Ferrari GT Le Mans there, which everybody, I'm sure, has probably seen on either YouTube or CNN. I know ran a story on it. I think they were even talking about it on the local news here. So, you know, that was obviously the big hair-raising moment as the Gainsco car. If you're not as familiar with the 24 hours, the sun does kind of become a problem as it sinks down below the bleachers for the drivers, especially inside the road course section. And as the sun was going down and the cars were driving into the sun, Gidley, who drives that 99 Gainsco car, ran right into the back of the Rizzi Ferrari.
Well, he was, to clarify a little bit, he was catching up on slower traffic.
Oh, yeah.
And then he darted to the left, you know, which would be a normal place to pass, and all of a sudden there was the other car almost dead stopped right in front of them.
Yeah,
and
it
he
just
didn't know where to go.
Yeah, it just so had happened. You know, normally you would think, oh, well, he pulled out and hit another car. That's okay. So what? They both kind of just spun out and hit the wall. Well, this car happened to have a really bad problem within the engine, so he was going nearly at a crawl, nearly at a dead standstill, compared to the flat out. Corvette prototype there, the Gaines Co., and he absolutely clobbered that Ferrari. I mean, I will tell you that I've seen some pretty jacked up accidents, you know, following racing, covering racing, obviously. Probably the worst that I ever seen was the Dan Weldon accident, obviously, just because of everything that was happening. But I will tell you that I will rate this as probably – that was probably the second worst accident I had seen, like, on the television or, like, you know, ever really when you think about it, just from the sheer velocity of the hit and what that car looked like afterwards. Ugh. Unbelievable. So you might
it was a 100-mile-an-hour hit.
Oh yeah, you might not. I mean, say what you will about the Daytona prototypes, and say what you will. I mean, they're ugly compared to the Le Mans prototypes. I agree, but it was safe, and they survived. You know, now granted, I made the mistake of saying I was happy they walked away. Granted, that was a figure of speech. Because nobody walked away from that one. They were both backboarded and taken to the hospital. Obviously, now we know that they're okay. So the Ferrari driver, he's okay. And then Mimmo Gidley had surgery on his arm and leg immediately and then had a further back operation since the accident and is said to be in good spirits, but will be a lengthy recovery for Mr. Gidley before if we ever see him in a race car again. If we do, you know, which I hope we do, it will be not this season, I assure you. So big impact. It brought the race to a stop for about an hour and 25 minutes. Outside of that, we had another pretty big accident in the middle of the night. Obviously, the Daytona 24 being what it was, we had a lot of attrition, a lot of cars falling out with just going behind the wall for quick repairs, lengthy repairs, full gamut of stuff that you get with multi-class sports car. And then we got to the last hour.
Well, before you even get to that, actually, I wanted to say one thing that car that went out a little bit earlier than I'd hoped it would. And, you know, we make fun of the Ace and Gary Delta Wing. You know what? That car was quick. It was a lot quicker than I thought it would be.
Yes. It was. It qualified well. It ran well. I don't think that since Le Mans last year, I don't think anybody has really, really said that it doesn't belong out there. I think it's just people are trying to warm up to it. You know what I mean? I don't think it's the black swan that it used to be, where it was like, oh my god, that car is so ugly and it doesn't belong on the track and I'm not gonna watch it and I hope it fails miserably. I think people are kind of interested in it. I know a lot of people said that at the Daytona 24, the Delta Wing was getting a ton of fan attention. Naturally, when you're the only car that looks like you do, you're gonna garner a lot of attention, especially when it looks
like a 2014 Formula One car.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh.
No, Gabby Chavez said it was really a lot of fun to drive and was fairly competitive until the transmission went into the uniform.
Yeah, it was. I think it qualified like seventh.
Yeah,
yes.
It's running in the top 10 there for the longest time before it had its terminal issues. But
it's a legit race car.
Oh, yeah. It is a legit race.
Yes, it can turn.
I don't think I'll tell you what. That little car got it going through the bus stop.
Yep.
Oh,
because
man.
You talk about a lot of lateral G load through the bus stop to make that quick change in direction. That little bugger stuck to the track. And I was like, damn. I was like, look at that Delta Wing get that bus stop. I was like, that's something else. I don't think it's supposed to turn like that. And then eventually you've seen the Wang get slammed into the tires and everybody had one of those ooh moments. But you know, it's
right.
Fun. I don't think there's anybody who can legitimately say, well, that's not a race car. It's a race car. And it's even such a race car, as we talked about last week, with the Nissan Z-Rod or whatever that thing is called, that funky Delta Wing Nissan. You know, I mean, it is a legitimate design. It is a legitimate racing machine, and people legitimately race that thing, and it did well. So we'll, I look forward to seeing what it does at Sebring and throughout the rest of the season. But getting into the last hour there, everything was hunky-dory. We had a nice battle shaping up between the Wayne Taylor Racing guys, Corvette Daytona prototype, and the Action Express Corvette Daytona prototype. Just a lot of strategy going down to the last hour there. And then we also had a battle, a really good battle shaping up for the GT Daytona fight as the Flying Lizard Audi. Oh, yeah. The Flying Lizard Audi R8, which was weird to say all weekend because I'm used to them being a Porsche, was in a nice fight with the Level 5 Motorsports Ferrari 458. Now, let me just stop for those who might not be as familiar. Those two teams, Flying Lizard and Level 5 Motorsport, are two of the heavyweights when it comes to sports car racing. Two of the biggest teams in sports car racing, and they are coming to blows for ultimate, you know, GT Daytona victory, you know, first year for both teams and in the class. And it was an absolute barn burner to the all the way down to the last lap. It was a little bit probably overly dramatic because we'll get into a number of things that happened through race control that actually kind of, I guess, manufactured the finish and then further ruined the finish in my book. Of the race, and that was we had the WeatherTech Porsche with I forget how much time was on the clock when it actually happened. It was I thought it was at like 25 minutes was when he went off into the
That's about right.
Tires. And he hit the tires, bounced out of the tires, and then drove off. That was right down there at the at the International Horseshoe.
Then they throw a yellow.
And
full course yellow for when they're supposed to do just local yellows or something like that.
Well, yeah.
All the other incidents that were similar, they did the same thing. Heck.
Yeah,
and then
Delta Wing nosed into the tires in a similar fashion, backed up and went going. There was no yellow.
You're going too fast. You have to stop.
I thought IMSA was the sanctioning body here, not NASCAR.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you're wrong.
See, with the sports car, just for the people who might not be as familiar, let's be honest, not everybody is hip with the road course racing. But for those who might be new to it, the fact is that's typically what we call a local yellow, where, you know, through that segment you slow down. You slow down to you still compete, but you don't pass cars and you don't break a certain speed going through there. And then the rest of the track is open so that you can pass. And these road courses are usually pretty big road courses, especially Daytona with the banking and the bus stop. And this incident, as we just discussed, brought out an uncharacteristic full course caution with 20 minutes to go. Now, as you said, Mr. Shaw, that was not what was needed in that situation because we had seen the Delta Wing bounce in and out and other cars throughout the night, you know, have these offs, stop, come back on, hunky-dory. Now, all of a sudden, to Doug's point, we start to look at the NASCAR side, that is what's running the Tudor Sports Car, United Sports Car Championship, and we look at the fact that, hey, we shouldn't be surprised that we're manufacturing drama at the end of a 24-hour race. And that was one of the issues in the off-season going into this season that many people had talked about was the fact that, you know, we could see stuff like this happening. Unfortunately, it was during the first race. And it kind of set up and manufactured a finish for us after, like, a 10-minute caution for a car nudging the tires. We're now set up with like a 10-minute, you know, 7-minute whatever shootout where we now have a battle in all the classes except for the prototype challenge. The prototype challenge, the core autosport guys had like a full lap on the competition. But now we see the gap between Action Express and Wayne Taylor Racing all but gone. We have now the GT Daytona battle, like, right there. And probably what I thought was the most dramatic change in climate for that class was the GT Le Mans. Because you have to remember, at about half an hour to go, we're talking about the 911 Porsche RSR factory team putting down the BMW Z4 of Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan, and Joey Han. We're talking about that car about to go two laps down, and through this whole entire exchange of events after a pit stop from the 911 RSR and this now full course caution, the BMW is actually made it to the lead lap in the GT Le Mans class and is a mere like 8 seconds behind the Porsche. I mean, so you go from 30 minutes, I'm almost two laps ahead of the closest competitor. I'm like, you know, about to turn on cruise control. I can see the BMW that's in second place. I'm about to put them two laps down to within 30 minutes. All of that is gone, and you are fighting for your 24-hour life against now the BMW that you had just seen. And again, this isn't because this is exciting, this is a sports car. This, ladies and gentlemen, was manufactured by this full course caution. So let's just, you know, while the finish was exciting and I was on the edge of my seat, as was probably a lot of people, this finish was manufactured. Now go further into the GT Daytona class where we had the Flying Lizard and the Level 5, a huge battle between these two teams. I mean, we've got cars passing each other. We've got cars sliding off into the bus stop and then coming back on and getting passed and then repassing on the banking. The Audi, I mean, this is a dogfight. This is what you live to see in racing. Two high-quality teams with high-caliber drivers absolutely going at it on, you know, probably the North American premier endurance race. And then on the last lap, we had a situation going into the kink, which is a high-speed, flat-out corner where you can take that in the GT, where the Audi decides that he's going to make his final stand against the Level 5 Ferrari and try to get around him on the outside, or at least, at a minimum, draw level going through the kink and then have the inside position going into the following hairpin. Now, what happened was the Audi got side-by-side, really kind of pushed the Ferrari there a little bit. Didn't touch him, but kind of made it difficult for him to make that corner. The Ferrari took the corner, held his line, had the preferred driver's line, and the Audi went off into the grass, came back onto the track, but at that point, you know, he was going to have to make like a last-ditch maneuver before they got to the banking, because unless something dramatic happened at the bus stop, that was essentially the race.
Yeah.
And it was going to be tough to regain in one lap or under a lap that momentum in which he had lost. And immediately after the race had concluded, as soon as the checkered flag – hell, I think it happened before the checkered flag, to be honest – the guys in race control – threw a penalty, a time penalty, at the Level 5 Ferrari and actually stripped them of the Rolex 24.
Wait, what was the penalty for?
That's what we're getting to.
The penalty that was explained to us after the race from race control was for avoidable contact. Now, as you watch it in real time, one could maybe assume, oh, that looked really close. He probably maybe bumped him a little bit. But,
and knocked him into the grass.
Yeah,
right.
And knocked him into the grass. That's fair. That's hard fighting for the victory. That's more than fair. But when you actually look at it, the Ferrari never touched the Audi. Now, some will argue, well, that's not really fair because, you know, the Ferrari slammed into the side of the Audi going through the bus stop the lap previous, and actually caused some damage to the Audi, the Audi's rear suspension, and was not penalized. However, as soon as this incident had occurred on track, there was an seemingly immediate time penalty handed out, snap overreaction from race control, in which we literally left coverage thinking that the Flying Lizard had won. Now, you'd be daft to think that that was going to stay that way, because what had then happened was, you know, everybody on Twitter's like, this is bull hockey. There's no reason why, you know, level 5 should have been penalized because for avoidable contact, you have to have contact. And what they're saying was, well, the Audi went offline and went off into the grass because if he didn't, he would have been hit. Now, I think that's kind of a bunk argument. But here's my take on the situation before we get into the overall results and everything. My thoughts on this is that the end – you know what this really reminded me of was one of the last IndyCar races at Toronto, or really any time IndyCar race control has ever been dealt with a situation like this where mistakes were made and a championship becomes – loses out its credibility immediately. And that's what happened with this situation, is that everybody knew that, for one, this was hard racing for the victory. After 24 hours, you are literally door-to-door with the guy that you've been racing for 24 hours straight. And now you're door-to-door, last lap, Rolex on the line, Team Glory on the line. For Ferrari, it marks their first victory, you know, since 1998, I believe is what they said. I mean, you've got a lot on the line here. So, you know, it's only normal for two cars, two drivers, two teams to battle like they did on the last lap, maybe make a little contact. But it's good, clean, respectable racing. Nobody from either team was calling foul. The only time that people started calling foul was when Ferrari got stripped of the win. Everybody's like, whoa, what the heck are you talking about? I think even the Flying Lizard guys were kind of like, well...
They were there. Good call. We'll take it.
not pretty, and not really sure what just happened, but hey, we'll take it. I'll take a watch. But,
yep.
You know, I think, you know, because the Twitter handles and everything for Flying Lizard, being the professional team they were, was not blowing up with, like, oh my gosh, we can't believe we just won the 24 hours. It was like, oh, okay. Yeah, good job. Good job by the Ferrari. All the credit at the end of the day for them being such a great team and, you know, all of that. So I think everybody was kind of taken back by race control's decision. But that being said, going forward, you know, this is something that the IMSA guys, because it wasn't even race control who went and reversed the decision. It was the next level of management had to step in and say, no, this isn't what happened. We're giving the win to Ferrari, as they rightfully should have. You know, I like everybody else, wanted to see the Audi win, wanted to see the Flying Lizard guys win. But at the end of the day, you know, the Ferrari won, and the Ferrari deserved the trophy and the watch and everything that goes with it. But this is something that IMSA has to watch. And I'm actually putting together an article that I'm going to probably have up by the time you listen to this, or probably a little bit after. But, you know, this is where they need to do, you know, be careful that they don't slide into an identity crisis. One of the things, you know, that we always talk about, we've always compared it to the North American open wheel merger, because it's really the only other thing that we've seen merge at this level. So they need to be very careful not to slip into the same kinds of race control mistakes and issues that IndyCar has made, and which will inherently be brought to their attention as a merged championship. They need to be careful with that, because they will lose that. I mean, as if NASCAR wasn't bad enough, I'm willing to see past that, but they will lose the credibility of being that defining North American sports car championship. They will lose credibility amongst the international community and competitors if decisions and mistakes in race control are made like this. There was no reason for that yellow flag, that full course yellow. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care about – I'm not bringing the Mimo Gidley accident into the equation. I'm not, okay? This is the way that things have happened. Local yellows have happened for years. That was a freak accident that happened. There was no reason why a full course yellow should have been thrown in that situation unless he came to rest on the track or posed an immediate threat to somebody. Which
or
he
if there
not.
Was enough debris on the track that needed to be cleared, which
yeah,
none
exactly.
of those were the case.
Which none of these were the case. It was a standard local yellow situation. Then, to manufacture the finish of your race after 24 hours, which, I'm sorry, the last few years hasn't needed manufacturing because the drama's just naturally been there, to turn around and then manufacture a finish, and then, on top of that, piss away what was good, hard, respectable racing between two tough drivers who had not one bad thing to say about each other after the race, and then to penalize somebody for something they didn't do is not the way that you want to establish the first race of your championship when you are trying to claim to be that respectable North American championship. And you're not only trying to change sports car landscape here in America, but also trying to change sports car landscape on a global stage. And with that, I'll open it up to the comments from you guys, starting with you, Shaw, because I know
giant intake of breath.
Yeah. I need some more Captain Morgan.
I think we'll see probably improvements maybe in those calls in the last lap kind of thing and let them kind of duke it out. But with it being the NASCAR guys, I think we'll see more of those manufactured yellows. They'll find any excuse. It won't be blatant like they're going to, you know. I guess to you and I, this was blatant. But for the general viewing public, probably not so much, right?
Yeah.
So I think we'll continue to see that. It's like, ooh, an opportunity to bunch up the field. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the other calls, I think we'll I'm hoping that they'll improve that, and I think they will. But, you know, so be it. You know, that it's manufactured stuff. It's what happens. It's NASCAR.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing going forward is, you know, now we're going to Sebring, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here you start off with the biggest race of your sports car season. Of course, the biggest race in sports car is Le Mans.
Well, yeah, biggest race in North America.
Right.
Premier event in North America.
Yeah, exactly. And you have, you take the full course out of it. You know, I don't want to talk about that just yet. But, you know, you look at the first 23 and a half hours, and you have a brilliant race, right?
Well, as good as it could be expected for the first race, I think. After we talk about the results, we can get into some of the balancing issues. I don't want to get into those immediately.
Yeah, we got new rules and all that stuff, sure.
Well, you know, we knew that there was going to be some balance issues, but, I've got some things to say about that as well. Not about the balance itself, but how it all went down. But coming out of this, instead of everybody talking about what a fun race that was, what nice battles we had there at the finish, instead we're sitting here talking about race control. You know, and those of us who are IndyCar fans know that the last thing you want to be your story coming out of a race is race control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they come out of this and they just have egg all over their face. It's maybe not the worst possible way, but it's certainly way down on the list of ways you wanted to come out of the 24. You know, it's not doing them any favors.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Brian Barnhart was consulted on their technical rules package.
You know, that was the first thing that happened. That was the first thing I thought of when that had happened. I was like, Barnhart.
Yeah, where is he? No, exactly. But you know, well, let's talk about the rules package, because that's something that if you don't make a regular habit of reading Gordon Kirby the way it is, you should. Sometimes you'll like it, sometimes you'll hate it, sometimes you'll love it, but it's always a good read. And he addressed something this week that really IMSA has to change. They have got to fix this. No one really understood what the rules were coming into coming down to Daytona. It seemed like the rules were constantly being changed, And as he put it, the sanctioning body felt, you know, it seemed to think that the teams could fabricate new parts and make changes to the car overnight, when really it takes at least a couple weeks just to manufacture the new bits, let alone do any development or testing. And so there's a lot of teams very upset about the cost escalation because of the continual updates and technical bulletins being released by IMSA.
Yeah. Well,
in my industry, that's called an architect supplemental instruction.
And it costs money, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, see, the architect supplemental instruction, when they're issued on a job, a construction project, typically it's the architect saying, hey, we're making this change to the contract documents, and our opinion is this should not cost you any money. It should not be a change to the contract sum. And almost every architect supplemental instruction, or ASI, that comes out is refuted by the contractors, because anytime you make a change to what the contract documents state, you are making a change to the total sum of the project. It doesn't matter that it may not be a material change, but just me looking at the piece of paper and reorganizing my staff to make it happen, that costs me money.
So I am altering the deal. Pray I do.
Exactly. and that's kind of the situation these teams are in. The you know, IMSA or NASCIMSA or whatever we're going to call it is making a change to the deal, and Lando just has to sit there and kind of swallow, you know. Gulp.
I want you to wear these clown shoes.
Exactly.
But, all right, well, we can get on more. We've still got quite a bit of time until we get to Sebring, and we can talk more about the technical rulings. But going ahead and moving into the results of the race, in the prototype, we had the number 5 Action Express, Bob Barbosa, Christian Fittipaldi, old IndyCar name for you guys, and current IndyCar name, Sebastian Bourdais. Take overall victory. So fantastic job. Bourdais keeps the IndyCar names alive there. The 911, the factory Porsche North American 911 RSR, making its debut this weekend, took first place in the achieved first place in the GT Le Mans category. So that's the pro high-end GT cars for those least familiar. And then in the prototype challenge, we actually had the core Autosport guys take the victory there in the prototype challenge. And in the final class, the GT Daytona, as we had mentioned, the Flying Lizard, not the Flying Lizard, I'm sorry, that does not reflect the appropriate result, does this unofficial results paper I'm looking at. But the GTD, the Level 5 Ferrari 458 Italia, piloted by Scott Tucker, Townsend Bell, and a host of other great talent, but those two probably stick out as the most popular names on the list there. They were able to take home the win after the penalty was overturned in the GT Daytona class. So fantastic race. It was a great race all up there until the snafu at the end. Notables, the Chevrolet Corvette team ran into some mechanical issues that prevented them from doing well in that stunning C7R. And the highest placed prototype was the Muscle Milk. The Muscle Milk, I don't think this – is it still Pickett, or is it just – no, it's just Muscle Milk Racing, isn't it? Nissan Orca with Lucas Lure finished in the fifth position, and they were the highest placed of the open top P2 racers. So that being said, as we mentioned, next stop will be at Sebring for the 12 hours. You shouldn't have much time to wait for that. I know I look forward to it, even though, you know, this past weekend kind of left a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth, as I never like to see race control overstep their bounds like that. But I still look forward to Sebring. I look forward to watching how this championship matures over the season for its inaugural season. And I look forward to some of the changes and stuff. And I would just stress to the people who are watching this championship, or maybe who are new to sports car, you know, just deal with the growing pains. It's going to happen. It's going to be kind of a painful season to get everything ironed out. It was relatively short notice where all this kind of came together anyways, so we will just watch, be patient. Now, one thing I will say is I certainly hope that the broadcasts get better, not so much from a talent perspective, but man, there were so many commercials. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I figured it out finally. The way it worked was is they'd say they're going to commercial, right?
Yep.
And they'd do like a string of like three or four commercials, about three or whatever. And then they'd come back, but you'd think they'd be coming back. But all they do is actually they do like a, I don't know, about a 10-second spot, just kind of flashing up that. And when we come back, we'll talk more about whatever, right? You know, it's almost like the stupid stuff that you see like after the evening news of the Extra or whatever. You know, it's like, next, we're going to talk about what's next. You know, and then they go to a string of another four commercials, and then they'd get to actually back racing. So I got used to finally fast forwarding through that little snippet that they kind of toss in the middle there.
So, but yeah, hopefully that gets better, because I know a lot of people are frustrated about that, myself included. So we'll see where it goes. But
you know,
so that's,
I do want to raise one thing that I really, really liked.
Okay.
That this was something that that I think Swift had had proposed back in the first round of IndyCar chassis proposals. And that was those, what do they call them, the Swift lights, speed lights, or whatever.
Oh, the numbers on the sides?
Yeah, that was
brilliant.
It was, wasn't it? I thought it was
that
very, very
was
clever.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that was awesome. The move to put that all of that stuff on there was fantastic to help people understand more what was going on, because let's face it, we know that sports car racing can be pretty difficult at times to follow.
Well, especially an endurance race, you know, and you've got all kinds of lap traffic and everybody's all mixed up. Having the different colors,
42
for the different classes
on the track at a time.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
different colors.
Like figuring out the GTLM versus the GTD. I mean, they look a lot the same. Yeah, you know, the cars look the same, even though technically there's some differences, right?
There's some big differences. But anyway, the different classes had different color numbers, and you know, the number represented their position in class. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. Of course, ALMS had the 1-2-3.
Yeah.
On the side, which was a good first step. But here you actually had a two-digit readout of their position in class. That
fantastic,
I thought.
Fantastic idea.
Yep.
Way to go, technology. That was awesome.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you can do when you're trying to keep the public entertained. I mean, you can put numbers on the side of the car, and you can throw phantom cautions. Great idea. Moving forward, though, from the sports car portion of the program. Oh, yeah, I'm awake from my little nap there. We are now moving to the rally portion of the evening's festivities. And Mr. Shaw, I've been hearing some rumblings about some WRC teams not happy with the promoter. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, this one's actually kind of a BS. I totally understand what it is. I mean, granted, they have live TV coverage going on both in the UK, and they had it in France for some of the stages. They had, broadcasting, you know, at least the, you know, the little overview thing, you know, in all these countries. The TV product actually was great. What they were complaining about in this case was specifically the fact that the promoter wanted to put cameras in the service park and have them running 24/7.
So, in other words, they were complaining that they didn't want to give coverage on television.
Right, but I can understand a little bit, though, from the service park side. When the cars aren't, they said that, you know, we're totally okay with this. They didn't tell them about it ahead of time, not until the event. And they arrived there and like, oh, by the way, we're going to set up a camera over here so we can keep an eye on you guys 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're totally okay with it when the cars are in service and the guys are working around. But you can understand from a legal standpoint, maybe during the time the cars are out on stage and they're racing, there might be stuff going on they don't want people to see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of their concern. They're like, you know what? We've got laws in our own country or in, you know, with our manufacturer or whatever, and we can't just have a camera here all the time because that goes against some privacy laws, for our employees and stuff. We just can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to clarify some of that stuff. So mostly just kind of a whine and complain thing. I mean, they had this new thing where if you were on the website during the Monte Carlo, where you could actually click on and had this live stream of the service part going on. But when the cars were not in service, the camera was just kind of on the other side of the road, basically, that went into the service park, just kind of just doing this overview. You didn't really get to see what was going on in the service parks. But really, there isn't that much that goes on in the service park in between. I don't know why anybody would really want to watch it too much. I think when they first tested the idea was in Portugal last year, and that one actually worked pretty well because they actually had a big screen TV that the camera was close enough to that you could see some of the action that was going on live if you didn't have any other coverage. It was like getting a live stream a little bit, or they'd have some recaps on there. So that was kind of neat, and I know that's kind of the idea what they're going for, but yeah, they need to clean up, and they need to just tell the teams. You can't just shove up a camera. You show up with a camera somewhere and say, "Yep, we're putting this here, right here," and you're gonna have to deal with it. So
I see. So yeah, there, like you said, there might be some legal issues, but in the end, it was really complaining because they were offering more coverage than the teams really wanted. Hey, win some, you lose some. Winning some, the weekend had the Rally America Snowdrift Rally, and winning this weekend was the Super Rally Team USA, Mr. David Higgins.
Yeah, you know what? David Higgins, obviously he led from the very start. Not without issues, by the way. there's a great picture of David Higgins coming through. It was in the first loop of stages, with the bonnet completely folded back into the windscreen. And, so something came loose, and the thing just flipped right up, and they still came through okay. You know, they got it refastened at the in-between stages and whatnot, made it back to service, and got the whatever was bent and broke, fixed on that. But it really what the big deal was is Lestage didn't pick the right tires. This is true with any time that you're in those kind of conditions, right? It started out with Lestage decided to pick the ice tires to start out with. Well, it turns out they got a little bit more snow than they thought they would as far as starting out. Higgins went with a snow tire, and he got a little bit more grip, and Lestage ended up losing like 30 seconds right in the first loop. Then came the night stages, and it turned out that Lestage says, well, you know what? I'm going to go with the snow tires this time. Well, on the second loop, the ice tires would have been the best decision, of which Higgins happened to get it right that time. So a little bit different way of going about it, and they just didn't weren't as competitive. Then the next day came around where they had the longer stages, and Higgins just was dominating. He's finally figured out how to drive on that slippery stuff without the studs and just pulled way ahead. He ended up finishing, gosh, what was it, a full – 2 minutes ahead of Antoine Lestage. So it was definitely quite the domination there. What was great to see was Lachlan O'Sullivan in a super production end up getting third on the podium overall. So once again, Snowdrift is one of those places where, you know, having all that power of the open class car doesn't necessarily make you the fastest. When you don't have any studs and it's all slippery conditions, you don't need all that power. It's all about getting good grip. Super production is probably going to be the highlight this year for competition. I'm really excited about it because you've got Lachlan O'Sullivan, who's won it before, and then David Sterricks, who, if you remember my article, I was complaining that Sterricks said he wasn't going to defend his championship this year. Well, apparently, he's going to do the whole thing and defend it. Enough people, like I said last week, I thought he was just coming back for Snowdrift and maybe 100 Acre and Oregon Trail. But he's actually going to do the entire championship. So enough people got a hold of him, and his sponsors stepped up. And he is going to defend the whole thing. Unfortunately for him, he was running in a he was actually running in the lead for a little bit, and then unfortunately had this electrical issue where his lights turned off in the middle of one of the night stages. And he ended up going off into a snowbank, and it was a high-speed corner that he went off at, and there was nobody could really stop. By the time they saw him, they were way too darn far down the course. They hit the brakes to slow down to try and pull him out. You can't go backwards on a stage. Not allowed. So they'd stop, and they'd just go sliding on by. So he didn't get pulled out for quite a while by the sweepers and just called it a night. He couldn't fix it. They ended up going back and having to DNF for the day and then super rallied the next day. Then it was that means Dylan Van Way, who's normally used to be in two-wheel drive, but he's now doing super production this year. Dylan Van Way ended up just taking it calm and keeping it on the road, ended up getting second. And last year's Rookie of the Year, Nick Roberts, ends up getting third on the podium in the super production, which is really good to see. He's the one that's got Rhiannon Gelsomino as his co-driver this year. So really good to see that. The other really cool battle that we're wanting to watch all season long is going to be in the two-wheel drive. Again, it's going to be the Ford versus the Scion, right? Team O'Neill now has Andrew Comrie-Picard, and Scion, now that ACP left, ended up bringing on Matthew Johnson. Matthew Johnson, you might well know from, he's competed at Rally America for many years, but then he's been doing all the YouTube videos for Rally America. So if you ever watched any of the video coverage, it's always been Matthew Johnson that's been hosting it. Anyways, Matthew got the deal. They called him up over at Scion Racing and said, hey, you want to drive our car. And now the ACP's left. And talk about a great job. ACP put it into a snowbank and got stuck. He didn't get pulled out for 30 minutes. And Matthew Johnson just said from the very beginning, he's just going to take it slow and careful. And if he feels like he's got an opportunity to go faster, he will. But he just kept it on the road and pulled out a dominant win. So Scion in the ugly little bread box toaster ends up getting the first win of the season there in two-wheel drive.
Well, okay, really, it was Matthew Johnson that got the win.
Okay, Matthew Johnson got the win in the
right.
Scion.
Yes, yes. Because, it was really the racecraft of the driver and co-driver more than the machine that earned that victory.
And what's interesting is that Matthew Johnson actually has Jeremy Wimpy as his co-driver, which used to be ACP's co-driver, but many years ago, back when Matthew Johnson raced in Super Production, he actually used to co-drive with, used to have Jeremy as his co-driver. So he got to renew his co-driving relationship with him, and apparently they hit it off right away as far as, getting things worked out. So a really good teamwork there. One of the great stories, though, that came out of this was the second-place finishers in two-wheel drive. These are the guys, they're also in a Fiesta R2, and it's one of the stories about the rally camaraderie. This little blip that came out of a Facebook posting that the team put up there. This is Troy and Jeremy Miller, they're brothers. And they said they're super pumped to get second place at their very first race competing at the national level. As I went to start the car for the practice stage Wednesday, the ECU melted itself, and there seemed to be no spare in the United States that would work. I thought my rally was over before it started. Then Chris Duplessis told me about the one in Dylan Van Way's Fiesta and put me in contact with Graham Evans and another guy there. Dylan told me that I could put use his ECU without hesitation, and Chris coordinated everything. John Hall, one of the other co-drivers out there, helped Graham with the swapping of the ECUs at 1 a.m. on Friday morning, and the car was running for the start of the rally. Without those guys' help and dedication, this rally never would have happened for me, and I owe them big time and can't believe that I got second place. You know, that is what's so cool about that sport. I love that grassroots stuff where everybody just kind of jumps in to help. Last minute, I mean, the whole freaking ECU melted. That's no fun. But ended up coming out as a second place for those guys. ACP still ended up coming back as third technically in two-wheel drive class, but really the B-spec of the Honda Fit that's been kind of running you know, B-Spec is a completely stock, other than tires and roll cage. They ended up...
Can't they do a little bit of suspension adjustment?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit.
I don't think you could do much engine modification.
No, none at all.
I thought you could put different springs and dampers on.
I'll have to get back to you on that. Yeah, probably. I mean, that would make sense, because, a gravel rally would just kill it.
Oh, yeah, it'd tear the crap out of a... Well, because I know that the Fiesta B-Spec package that you can get from Ford Racing includes beefier sway bars and coilovers, actually.
Okay. That's right, because the Fiesta normally is that weird torsion thing, right? Normally?
For the rear, a torsion bar. And it still will, right? It's not necessarily an independent rear suspension.
Right.
But a rear torsion bar might as well be an independent rear with a pretty stiff anti-sway bar, right?
Something like that.
It's real, real similar. Let's be honest. What's the rear end of the car there to do in a front wheel drive?
Oh, in a front wheel drive, yeah. It's just falling along behind.
Yeah, it's to keep the gas can from scraping along the road, right?
Something like that.
Oh, okay. It's a little bit more to it. Most of your stuff is happening up front. But yeah, I was thinking the rules might be different for rally, but if they're calling it B-Spec, then I think the rules are that you can swap out your dampers.
That makes sense.
But I know you can't put any go fast engine parts on it.
Right.
You can't up
right.
the boost yeah, or anything.
Not at all.
Like that.
Nope. The other driver that's in B-Spec was out there last year as well is Tag Rally Sport, that little Toyota Yaris, the one they call the Jelly Bean. Unfortunately for them, on the second day on Saturday, they broke a hose when they were in transit or somewhere along transit. The fluid actually froze. It was that cold out there.
Scott Raines, a photographer, brilliant, brilliant photographer. It goes to all the Rally America events. He was talking about how just brutally cold it was. I'm looking at some of his photos there on Facebook, and they're amazing. But I'm thinking, oh, I hope 100 Acre Wood is a lot warmer than that. Damn.
Second.
<Yeah. laughs> Yes, I thought you might.
Yeah, you had it was definitely cold out there. David Higgins himself even tweeted that, huge thanks to all the volunteers and the crazy fans that were out there cheering them on in those conditions, because it was bloody cold.
Yeah, keep in mind, this is in northern Michigan, right? It's not in the UP, but it's about as far north in the mitten as you can get, right?
Yeah, it's Atlanta's ways up there. It's definitely pretty darn chilly, and especially with the weather's been in the Midwest lately, downright frickin' cold. So that was it for the first event. Really excited for 100 Acre Wood, though. 100 Acre, we should see Ken Block back. We should see Travis Pastrana in there now for the open class. That'll be good to see. I'm excited also again with the super production. I'm wanting to see that those guys be able to be on a surface that's a little more familiar to them. There's a little bit of luck that goes involved with snowdrift. It's a tough one.
Don't get me started on luck.
Okay.
Well, my point, Johnson won not because of luck.
No, he was smart.
Because of superior racecraft.
He kept it on the road and didn't overcook it. And yeah,
make your own luck.
So on Saturday, there was actually this interesting image that came out from Instagram and on Facebook and pretty much blew up everywhere, which I wrote an article on. And this little image that showed up had an NBC Sports logo on it, and it showed follow the action, and it has Rally America on it. It's this little flyer, and it shows these air dates of the NBC Sports showing Rally America. How about that?
Haven't we been saying for, I don't know, ever?
and especially last week.
Yes. Well, who knew that they actually listened to us? That's awesome.
Yeah. Yes. And actually, Doug, you had even said, just a week ago that, we were talking about the costs and stuff like that for these smaller teams that, they're charging these extra media fees or three times the cost for a national entry and all that stuff, and they don't even have a media outlet,
Right.
And if people want to do their own media, they're charging exorbitant fees for their own media guys to be out there. It's like, come on. Can't you guys at least get on one of these, MAV TV or some other small, or lesser well-known sports outlets for just at least the recap? You had stated that in a reply to ACP's actually comment on the article that I wrote about the problems.
Yeah.
And turns out, somebody must have been listening a little bit.
Hey!
Yay, yeah. Somebody listens to us.
So, I'm really happy about that, and I know a lot of other people are as well. We've gotten a lot of very excited, positive feedback after you posted that article or posted that Twitter picture. And this is something that people have been hoping for a very long time. Teams and fans, right? I mean, we've been jonesing for some televised rally action for years, and ever since Speed Vision. Or was it Speed at that time? When they stopped carrying the WRC on a regular basis, seeing Rally on TV, it pretty much just dried up for us here in the U.S.
It did, and and that's what, if you're going to get a sponsor on board to help you out, if you can say that you're going to be on national television, they're going to give you a few extra bucks. that's just the way it works. Their name to be on national spotlight, that's a big deal. You might think that I'm gonna take back my earlier comment that I said that there's problems with Rally America and all that stuff. Some of that, I'll take it back, because at that time the entire article was based on the fact that there was no media outlet.
Right. But
I'm not gonna take it all back, because one thing that they totally screwed the pooch on, in my opinion, and by the way, there still has not been an official, this might be still under NDA, I'm not sure, but there has not been an official announcement or press release from Rally America about this TV coverage.
No, none.
But I can tell you with 99.99% certainty that this is going to happen. And not only from the official logo and all that stuff, but because there was the company that's doing the production of it is Rage Films. They're actually based out of Bend, Oregon. They're well known for doing extreme, like skiing, snowmobiling, and stuff like that, action sports videos. And then Katie Osborne, who's done the Global Rallycross coverage, she's a little correspondent that's been out there. She had already been on Instagram saying, doing a new project for NBC Sports, blah, 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 out here at Snowdrift in Atlanta, Michigan. Okay, well, that kind of...
There you are, then.
There you go, right. So it's happening. It's definitely happening. But one thing that pisses me off is this is the stuff that should have been nailed down in the off season and then let people know, because I think a lot more teams would have gone into the national championship, not just the regional stuff, and could get the money from the sponsors to plan ahead for a full championship push if they would have known about this ahead of time.
Well, I mean, that's just it. The teams would have had more ammunition to, more details, more value to take to sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the, you can look and say, well, the entries are still up. Well, yes and no.
Well, national entries.
Well, that's what I say. It depends on how you do the accounting, doesn't it? And so I don't think you would have seen the movement away from the national championship that we have if this would come out. And, but, you know, it might have been a thing where it wasn't – you couldn't have done it sooner, where you were still in debate, negotiations with NBC. I don't know. You know, we can sit here and prognosticate and say, yeah, you should have had this done sooner.
Right.
It would have been nice to have it done sooner, but it might have been a situation where, you know, it takes a long time to get these types of deals hashed out, and it might have just taken longer than they had expected.
Yeah, that's true. But for... You'd think that they'd be able to contact directly some specific teams that are known to have wanted to compete and say, look, there's a possibility.
No, I don't think you can do that.
Yeah, maybe not.
You know, and it goes back to the whole NDA thing. You know, when you've got a contract under negotiation, you know, one of the things that will kill that.
You wouldn't have to say with who.
No. But hear me out. One of the things that will kill that contract, kill those negotiations faster than anything, is a leak. You know, we've seen a few times when drivers are working on a sponsorship deal, and something gets leaked a little early by maybe an excited crew member or the driver themselves, and all of a sudden, boom, that's it. Deal's over. And so, I don't know. Yes, of course, it would have been nice to have this earlier, but maybe it wasn't possible. But I'm glad we have it now. And now going forward,
what I was going to say is that, you know, the national entries, like I said, that seemed like they were lacking a little bit. You might see those start to tick up now, because now that people are seeing this, there's some people I've been hearing from, and if they get the deal together, I'll bring it up. But there's people I know of out there that are well-known names that are committing to go drum up money to join the championship now.
Wasn't Duplessis one of those that was that thought now there might be enough interest he could come back and perhaps do at least a partial run?
That's one of the names I was hearing.
It'd be nice to see him back on the stages.
Yeah, I think a two-wheel drive championship with Duplessis versus ACP versus Matthew Johnson.
Boy,
that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep,
nothing. I mean, this is my dream shot, right? You've got Pastrana, Higgins, Block, and Lestage in open class. You've got Sterix, O'Sullivan as the guys that are super experienced, plus the young guns of Dylan Van Way and this young Nick Roberts in super production. I'd like to see a few other names that in the Northwest here in the super production as well, especially Dave Henderson, who's I think should do a national push sometime because he's so damn quick. And then in two-wheel drive, yeah, having ACP versus Johnson versus getting Chris Duplessis in there, and I'd like to see that damn GT86 from Nameless get out there with Will Orders. I don't know if they're going to be able to drum something together right away, because they got their own little championship now kind of going on. That's kind of nice lead into the next article here. I had mentioned it before, but now it's kind of more official. They got their website up. The Cascadia International Rally Championship. They launched their website officially this week. And I'm going to try and cover it as much as I can with going out to the events and whatnot. And really what it is they're making kind of a sub-championship by combining some of the events that are regional or even part of Rally America and part of the Canadian Rally Championship. So the events that encompass this are the Oregon Trail Rally, the Olympus Rally, the Idaho Rally, the Pacific Forest Rally, which is part of the Canadian Rally Championship, Rocky Mountain Rally, which is also part of Canada, and the Big White Rally, which is also in Canada. So three U.S. events and three Canadian events that combine together to make this Cascadia National Rally Championship. There's a lot of good drivers here in the Northwest, and as we said again and again and again, we're underserved by motorsports in general, and a lot of the guys here love rally because of the fact that it's any weather type of motorsport. So some exciting stuff that'll go on there. I'll let you know more as I get more details on who all the names are that are going to be in it. And I think it'll be a good little sub-championship. It'll be neat.
Yeah, very cool. Like you're saying, it makes a lot of sense for these teams that are based in the West Coast to stay on the West Coast and not try and compete in a major national championship that only has like one round in their region.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to haul cars all the way across the East Coast all the time.
Well, it's especially difficult to sell sponsorship for events that aren't where your sponsors are likely to be or do business, right?
Yep. The only exception I could see with that would be the Nameless Performance guys, because they're a nationally known name.
Well, right.
And their sponsorship would work wherever they go. It's
most
their market.
People that are out drumming up
people,
sponsorship.
Right. It's
know,
local or regional guys. Yep.
Yeah. And
it's,
they're looking at
you know,
local and regional
BJ's,
businesses.
You know, it's going to be like BJ's auto parts store or something as their sponsor. And they're only located, you know, in one city or two, right? So that kind of stuff. So that's it for rally news. I guess we'll move on to the angle of the dangle news with Formula One and hand off to Mr. Weitzel.
Oh, hand off.
Yes. Well, you know, I washed my hands after I went to the bathroom. Anyway.
TMI.
Launch and testing. Launches started to happen Thursday last week with McLaren launching first and then Ferrari on Friday. And then all through the weekend, we got shots of these new cars in their first reveals. I think the first thing we saw was a Williams render of what their car was going to look like. And it kind of looked like Max Rebo of Return of the Jedi fame, if you recall him from Jabba's Sail Barge. He's the big blue alien playing the keyboard with the long, droopy nose.
Yes. The blue elephant guy.
Yeah. We got to start seeing these new cars as it built up to today when the rest of the cars were shown. And at this point, we've seen renders or full shots of every car that's going to be competing in the championship this year. And I would have to say that the noses that we're seeing now aren't exactly the noses that are going to be running the championship. There's going to be changes on these things all year long. So as we've been used to seeing the wings change, I think the noses are going to change just as much as the wings have changed in the past, because you're going to realize benefits and detriments of all these designs as time goes on, and people are going to scramble to go towards the one that works the best. But let's talk about these new cars, because obviously these new cars, the big thing is what these noses look like. Red Bull has launched their car, and it's not the craziest looking concept, but it definitely goes from the hump of the step nose that we used to have and goes down at a nice straight angle down to the nose, which I don't know. It's kind of a point at the front, but it also has a droop underneath, and it's not unflattering, though it isn't the most flattering thing I've ever seen. Ferrari looks something like a vacuum cleaner. Mercedes kind of has that same Ferrari look of a vacuum cleaner. McLaren definitely has more of a male phallic shape to the front of their nose, and that's where we're starting to sloop and slouch towards Gamora here, because Lotus they went with a different take. They have two prongs coming off the front, and the funny thing is the regulations dictate that there has to be one. It dictates a single nose, and how they got around this regulation is one of their prongs sticks further out than the other prong. So you've got one prong on the right and one prong on the left, and the right one sticks out a little bit further than the left one. And you know, I mean, the right one usually anatomically is anyway. Never mind. But Lotus's take on this has garnered a lot of criticism, simply because the Lotus isn't fitting with form that everybody else thinks that these cars should take, and some legality challenges have already been lodged against said Lotus nose. Sauber definitely has the the male anatomy in mind with the design of their front nose, and so does Williams, and so does Toro Rosso, and Force India definitely.
That's
the one that needs to have like a big black box interposed over the picture,
right,
when this car is on track. Yeah, pixelated. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Same with Caterham.
Yes. Well, Caterham has Caterham
wedge.
Of all the cars that are out on the track, the Caterham to me is maybe the most interesting with what they've done with this nose, because they basically kept a traditional high nose with a very flat section, you know, a flat top to the monocoque, and it comes out to a nice point about where the traditional high nose was. And then it droops down from underneath and comes out to attach to the wing. It's a very different take than anybody else has put on this car. And again, they've gotten some legal, rules, legality lawyers questioning that if it's appropriate or not. I mean, it's not appropriate for the kids, but maybe it's appropriate for the F1 track. But the thing that I worry about with this design is because they're coming down with this single member, if you will, it's coming down to a specific point where it attaches to the wing, and it's a very narrow connection point to the wing. And regardless of if it's legal or not, I'm wondering if that wing is going to be able to withstand the stresses put on it with that very narrow attachment point. It almost seems like side-to-side lateral forces on that wing would tear it apart. You know, fulcrum and lever and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, no, I think you're right. It doesn't seem like a whole lot that's going to hold that Caterham in place. And then are you going to see that, you know, all the forces that you're looking to get off of that wing to influence the rest of the car, is it all just going to go into twisting action that could just, it's not really going to give you the benefit that you'd want?
Bad harmonics, the front wing breaking into oscillations. I'm thinking this as definite issues, you know. But as far as testing went today, Red Bull ended up pulling the car out of the garage and doing some installation laps. They did 3 laps, and that was it on track at Jerez today. Ferrari had quickest time of the day with Kimi Raikkonen. He did 31 laps, but also spent some time on the back of a flatbed as it toured the track. Everybody had issues, and everybody had things they had to work out, but the Ferrari put in the most laps today. Mercedes did about 18 laps with Lewis Hamilton. Their issue was they had a catastrophic front wing failure, and Hamilton straight-lined it out of basically turn one and blew it right into the tire barrier. It sounds like everything's okay with the car because they're expecting to be back testing tomorrow.
The wing broke off? Is that what you said, right?
Yeah, the front wing broke. You know,
weak attachments again.
It could have been. Who knows? They've got some testing to do and see if it's a problem with the wing or just a problem with the fab that they did on that specific one wing, or if it's a design problem. But they were second quick today, which, you know, that's not a big deal. I mean, people aren't here to test for speed. They're here to test for reliability and proof of concept. Hey, it actually runs.
Yeah, the new engines. That's right.
McLaren definitely had that issue. They had electrical and hydraulic problems today. They had no testing, and they spent the entire day tearing down and reassembling the electronics and hydraulics on the car. Lotus was not at the first test. They were not planning on making it to the first test, so no surprise. They're a little bit behind. I guess they did have some good news, though. They got some talk about Russian funding. They've gotten a Russian partner who's buying into the team. Not sure if that's totally 100% legit or has actually gone through, but that's what they're talking about. So good news for Lotus, bad news for Lotus. They weren't there today. The other bad news for Lotus is Eric Bouyer, their team principal, is leaving Lotus, or their team technical director is leaving Lotus, and some saying that he's going to McLaren. Because when McLaren launched their car, they said nothing about their team boss, Martin Whitmarsh, at all. in all the press releases, nothing was said about Martin Wishmarsh. He's not at testing. He's not been involved with the launch of the car, anything of that nature. Ron Dennis has taken the team back over, and there's been lots of rumors that Ross Brawn is on his way to McLaren, and now Bouyer leaves Lotus, and they're thinking that that's what's happening, that he is actually going to be the guy that takes over at McLaren. Other people taking laps. Sauber took about 7 laps today. Williams did 7 laps. They were third quick. Toro Rosso 15 laps. Force India 11. Caterham 1. And Marussia was not at the test, but they're hoping to be there by the end of the week. Exciting. It's just fun to see these cars actually on track and making laps. I mean, it's just like with the Delta Wings when they first started to take laps, and we got to see these concepts realized. These new F1 cars are definitely that, these concepts being realized. And the engines will be fun to see them worked out. But Kimi Raikkonen actually said today, it wasn't all that different than what I've driven before.
I've heard a lot of people were saying actually the sound, they actually kind of enjoyed it, bringing back the turbo sound.
Well, and the turbo and the engine note that I've heard from it, from a few videos and audio of the cars, it's a pleasing sound, unlike the high-pitched scream that these cars have had before. A lot of people think the sound of F1 is so important. Well, I'll tell you, the sound of F1's great. I just kind of like the idea of the sound being a pleasant sound instead of a deafening
shrill
sound.
Yeah.
Shrill. I mean, IndyCar went through that. IndyCar went from their shrill car to most recently this pleasant turbo, and this pleasant turbo is wonderful to sit in the stands and listen to. Definitely worth the change. The only other thing in F1 is Bernie has had his New York case against him dismissed. A firm was suing him, saying that they were in line to potentially bid on F1, but they weren't asked to submit a further bid, and they wanted to claim legal this, that, and the other. New York did not dismiss the case outright on grounds. They dismissed it on venue. The New York court said, we're not even going to rule on the facts of the case because this isn't the proper venue. All the events took place in the UK and Germany, and therefore it should be tried there. So that's it. That's our F1 wrap up. More testing underway through the rest of the week, and then there's more preseason testing. There's 2 more test sessions after this. Will be fun to see as these cars come to life. And that would be it for F1, unless there's any other saved rounds out there for the F1 coverage this evening.
Just that there should be some interesting sponsors this year, probably Durex and Trojan out there.
There's already a plethora of Photoshop.
Yes.
It's rather interesting what people have been able to Photoshop. I mean, there's one of kids sliding down the nose of the Ferrari because it has a very steep angle and looks something like a slide. There's one of the Mercedes, the McLaren front wing, attached to an elephant as if it were its ears and face. And there's a lot of fun stuff out there. And obviously there's some ones that accentuate the nature of the dangle.
The fallacity.
Yeah, the fallaciousness.
Exactly.
You know, I will say, all of this is predicated by Formula One's insistence on over-regulating the chassis design. They continue to just squeeze down on every little detail of the chassis, right? You know, it's almost to the point where, why don't you just specify the parameters for the chassis? Say, here is the spec build that all of you will fabricate.
Here are the dimensions. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. really
put it in
almost
your carbon
like
fiber
that.
Maker bot.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. You know, here's the make file. Go. I would like to see move back to a more open time when we... Here's what I'd like to see for the chassis. I would like to see something that says it has to have a minimum of four wheels. It has to fit into this box. Done.
Yeah, there's...
Okay, there's, you know, you're going to bring up the cost-cutting thing, right?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
No,
carry on then.
Formula One isn't about cost-cutting. If you're in Formula
Thank
One...
Thank you!
...and you want to cut costs in Formula One, that means you're losing at Formula One and you don't have sponsorship.
Exactly.
I don't really care about the cost-cutting argument.
Okay.
The one thing I will say is, yes... they are held to very tight structure and stricture on what they can do with these cars. But it is interesting to see that the FIA came out with these new regulations, and what their intent was that everybody have a lower nose. And what the interpretation of the final writing of the rules was, everybody has a different take on it.
Yeah.
And everybody has a different idea of what they want to do to maximize the amount of airflow in the places that they think is important for their chassis.
But, you know, I will say that what we have now, the car design that we have now is extremely artificial.
True.
If you had an empty box and say, put a car in this, you wouldn't get anything near the type of car that we're seeing now.
Very true.
Yeah, well, and let's also throw this out, because this is worth mentioning. This oddly shaped bit of carbon fiber at the front of the car is one of the few changes that it's really not all that important. It is important to the car, but the most technically demanding portion of this car that took. Place, you know, redesign that took place in the off season are these engines. These engines are phenomenally different, and they're amazing pieces of technology. And we're getting distracted by little dangly bits of carbon fiber at the front of the car.
That's very true.
That nose has done a great disservice to Formula One, and I think it will all season, because that's going to be the talking point, because it's visible.
Yep, you're right. I mean, oh man, I tried to follow an article about all the different regeneration systems for power with this new engine technology. Holy crap, dude.
Yeah.
It is extremely complex, but yet amazing and cool at the same time.
And it's lost in the noise.
It is. And, you know, Bernie can go out there, and he has, complaining about how this noise issue is such a big deal in F1. And we really need to keep these V8s, because it's far more important to have this screaming, overwhelming sound fill the air when they're at the track. And unfortunately, he's chattered and chattered away on this. And all the while, the FIA did an end around and did some ridiculousness at the front of the car. And Bernie hasn't said word one about it, because he didn't realize it was going to be such a big issue. And now all this chatter that he made about the sound of these cars, it's immaterial, because the thing that stands out that's laughingly ridiculous about these cars is this piece of carbon fiber off the front that looks like a piece of the male genitalia.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Isn't it fun that one of the biggest development pieces on this car this season will be the shape and size of something that, you know, it really shouldn't matter what the shape or the size is. It's how many times. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. I've had enough of this F1 talk. Let's move on to the end of the show. Gentlemen, before we close out for the evening, any saved rounds, any last thoughts, anything else that we should throw out before we shut down the airwaves?
Hey, congratulations to Shelby Blackstock, for winning the Continental Tire Series race there at Daytona. I should have mentioned that when we were talking about sports cars earlier, and I didn't. You know, of course,
I don't think we got a chance to say anything with Sean going.
No, he was on a roll, wasn't he? We know him, of course, through Maserati to Indy. Yeah. But you know, he has been doing a fantastic job in sports car racing as well. So, congratulations, Shelby. It's a fantastic run.
Very cool.
And for me, next week I'll be talking about Rally Sweden. The next round for the WRC is coming up. And I did want to say one last thing. Seems like Crazy Leo, if you guys remember Crazy Leo Ulrichich
from
Canada.
Absolutely.
He looks like he's going to be doing an announcement in February. And rumor has it he might be making a WRC 2 debut in Portugal.
Ooh.
So don't know what kind of car yet. But
I did see on his Facebook he's got a if you haven't liked his page yet, go do it. There's a really, really cool piece of artwork, little new logo that he has, and so maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But anyway, it looks really darn cool.
Which one are you talking about? Not the Subaru.
It's a caricature type of little thing. I mean, it's just normal orange.
Yeah, that's theme. No, that's just somebody did that artwork of the Subaru that he used to drive. That's the Beast.
Okay.
Yep, that's the Beast. He's not doing that.
However, it's very cool little piece of artwork.
Yes, no, it's an extremely good piece of artwork. That's one of the guys in Toronto there, one of his fans did that. That's a really good artist. And yeah, that is a cool picture of what he calls the Beast. And actually, the Beast was running in Snowdrift, just not with Leo at the wheel. Car was rented out by another Canadian couple. So,
very cool. Yep. Well, gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the show. We thank you for listening to Open Paddock this evening, and we'll see you next week.
Have a good night.